Hello and welcome back to the Goodness Lover Show. Today we're joined by medical doctor and best-selling author, Gemma Newman, who's here to talk to us all about stress, not what it just does to us mentally, but physiologically, and how you can combat stress by choosing what's on your plate. Let's get into it.
Dr. Gemma Newman, it is awesome to have you on the show with us today. How are you doing today? You're tuning in from UK at the moment?
I am. I am a long way away, but obviously it's nice to see you so personally, face to face, and it's been a real pleasure to be invited. So thank you for having me.
Awesome. So I think you're our first UK guest, which is great as an Australian to go back to the motherland as to where this all came from. So thank you so much as our first UK guest on this podcast. But today we're talking about stress, plants and food. But I'd be really curious to start. You're a medical doctor and would love to hear more about your qualifications and how you got into this. But what was your story? Why did you decide to go down a more holistic path as in your medical practice?
Oh, well, thanks for asking. And it has been a journey. But I have to say, I did always want to be a doctor. You know, it was something that was really important to me from quite a young age. I love the idea of helping people. I know it sounds corny, but it's true. And when I got into medical school, I was very young and I was very excited about the prospect of saving lives. Leaving medical school and actually going out to the real world was quite different. There were times at which we were doing an incredible job and people were coming in extreme circumstances, we were helping them. But other times I realized that a lot of the things that people were suffering from, those chronic diseases that led to them being in the hospital, it was really very hard to address those things. So I decided to go into general practice because family medicine meant that I could essentially attempt to save lives in slow motion. You know, you can get to know your patients, you can get to know their families, their circumstances, where they came from, why they do the things they do, and hopefully, you know, plant those seeds of change. But again, I felt like when I went into general practice, it was really hard to help people to change their lives. And it was really hard to help people to feel better. I was doing a lot of chronic disease management, as I still do, prescribing medications, tinkering with those medications, trying to get their blood pressure down, trying to get their diabetes control a little bit tighter. But watching that gradual decline still, and feeling as though, you know, they weren't necessarily getting better. So I did what I do. And I thought, well, what else can I do to try and help these patients of mine to feel better? I researched psychology, solution-focused brief therapeutic approaches, CBT. I had a vague idea that nutrition would be helpful because I realized that obviously the food that we eat is the building blocks for what we create in our bodies. But I didn't really know exactly how. I just thought, well, you know, the usual sort of background hum of making sure that you move more, eat less if you wanted to lose weight, and maybe cut the carbs and have more sort of skinless chicken and fish and salad and that kind of thing. And it was interesting because I, in parallel, also had my own health journey because I wasn't looking after myself during my training. We had long hours, we had night shifts, I was exhausted. I would just grab what I could on the wards and I felt really sluggish. I felt tired. I'd get home from a long shift. I'd barely be able to eat my dinner before falling asleep. And so it was at that point I thought, I'm in my 20s. I need to be full of energy. I need to be able to work to help my patients. And so that's when I also started to think, okay, well, what can I do for myself? And interestingly, at that time, I hadn't researched nutrition specifically, only in the sense that I knew at medical school that there were certain nutritional deficiencies that we had to be aware of. But I decided to just kind of cut the carbs, move more, eat less. And it worked. I was able to have a lot more energy. As a side effect of that, I also lost some weight. And I felt, you know, I felt much more able to do my job. But the big shocker was when I checked my blood profile and I realized that I had a raised cholesterol and lipid profile, even in my physical prime, you know, working really hard to make sure that I was in a healthy place. And that really shocked me. And I thought, well, that's just my genetic destiny. I'm just going to have to live with the fact that that's my body, and I can't do anything about it. And, you know, sometimes that's true. But I also later on discovered that there were plenty of ways in which I could help bring my cholesterol down through the food that I was eating. And that journey happened through my husband, who's not medical. So he was running in the London Marathon. He was trying to improve his performance. He was trying to figure out, well, how can I run like these ultra runners that run 2-3 marathons in one go? And he was struggling with injury. So he started to look up the work of Rich Roll. He read Finding Ultra. He read Brendan Brazier's book, Thrive. He read Scott Jurek's book, Born to Run, arguably one of the most well-known ultra marathon runners of all time. And he started to sort of implement that in his life. And I was hugely skeptical because I thought, well, this is odd. You know, you're cutting out huge food groups. It can't be healthy. You'll get, you know, you'll get protein deficiency, all the things that you sort of might wonder as a person that hadn't really looked into plant-based nutrition. But I was really surprised because he was able to improve his marathon running time incredibly. He went from running the marathon before he made the changes to after, and he improved his running time by 1 hour and 10 minutes, which was absolutely phenomenal. And it got my attention. So I began to do some of my own research, and I began to understand the power of plant-based nutrition. And for me, it wasn't about athletics. It wasn't about sporting prowess. I just wanted to help my patients. And so I began to research, well, what could it do for someone who has heart disease? And what could it do for someone who wants to prevent cancer? And what could it do for someone who's having hormonal issues? And what could it do for somebody with diabetes? And time and again, I began to see, actually, from the data, that there are tremendous benefits. And so I decided to check it out, do it for myself. And I did it secretly to start with because I didn't want to lose face with my husband. I didn't want to fall flat and fail. I thought, well, I'll just start cooking plant-based meals and I won't make a big announcement. And then lo and behold, about a month after I'd made the changes, I decided to get a blood test. And I realized that for the first time in my adult life, I've been able to bring my lipid profiles into the normal range. And another benefit, which I hadn't really factored in, was that when I was running, I no longer had knee pains, which I've been suffering from throughout my 20s. And I began to realize that this could really work. And then, of course, the magic happened when I had the confidence, both from personal experience and from research, to start recommending it to my patients.
Wow, that's awesome. So I guess that brings in the plant perspective. So yes. You are now the plant-powered doctor. So I'm guessing this has taken quite the hold on your entire practice.
Well, yes, I think it's really funny, isn't it? Because there are so many aspects to my practice and how I communicate with my patients. And psychology and behavior change has been a really important part of that. But absolutely, when I discovered the tremendous benefits of plant-based nutrition, that's why I decided to go on to social media, because I realized at that time that there weren't really, in my experience, any doctors particularly talking about it. And I really wanted to get people to understand far and wide what they could hopefully achieve. And so that's where my plant power doctor moniker came from. And then, of course, it turned into the best-selling book, which is lovely. And yes, it does inform my practice. You know, it's something that I aim to include in one way or another, if it's something that my patients are receptive to. You know, if they, you know, just planting that seed sometimes patients want to make tremendous changes straight away if they're particularly motivated or if they're in a difficult place. But everybody's different. And that's the magic of being human, I think, is that we're all on different journeys at different times. But I do aim to talk about the power and benefits of healthy plant-based nutrition as much as I can.
Well, if you allow me to be a skeptical patient that's walking into your practice and I look up and I'm like, well, Dr. Gemma, I've looked at this food pyramid my entire life and I'm supposed to have a balanced thing of dairy and, you know, and meat is supposed to be in there. And that's how I generally feel if I'm going to live a healthy life, that's what I'm supposed to do. How are plants supposed to fill up that pyramid that we've maybe been led to believe is the optimal way to eat healthily and balanced?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm so glad you asked. I think What I tend to do in my practice is ask them questions first, because if I state, well, you should eat more plants, they immediately would come back with a question like that. And I think for me, what's important is actually finding out what's important to them first. And it varies from person to person. So, you know, if there's a man who's had a cardiac event and he wants to improve his angina so he can walk his daughter down the aisle, then that's what I'll focus on. And if there is, you know, a woman who's, mother has recently had breast cancer and she has she's wanting to reduce her risk, that's the kind of thing that I would focus on. So it's about finding what's important to them and focusing on that and the data that would support that. And you know, I think generally people understand that dietary guidelines tend to come from looking at broad swathes of data and broad populations. And when you want to use what your nutrition for a specific intervention, then it's quite a different prospect than just generally sort of balanced advice. And you know, sometimes I might talk a little bit about how industry can inform the popular zeitgeist, which I think is something that, you know, some patients want to talk more about. But ultimately, I focus on them and what they need from the consultation and what they would like from their life moving forward. And if I can share bits of information that they're receptive to when it comes to their condition or the thing that they're interested in, then that's when they're far more motivated to make a change.
Interesting. Cool. Well, say we know a lot of people, you know, if we were to collectively say in our community that stress has been a massive problem, obviously facing us all through this pandemic. So what role does food have in reducing stress, and what are some other interventions that we can use to reduce our stress, and what impact does that have on this big bad word that everyone talks about called inflammation?
I mean, food can be tremendously powerful. And it's interesting because I talk to my patients a lot about the stress that we've had during the pandemic. And I think it's quite hard because I see patients who are really struggling. You know, they've got different financial circumstances, huge stresses, anxiety, and it's hard for them to make changes sometimes. But when I talk about how food can be beneficial, then it's something that they can actually take control of in a relatively short space of time. So it can be really helpful for them. Yeah, so I would say that food has a really important role to play for people. It's something that people can do, which is quite practical to help them to feel better. But I also want to point out that it's not as simple for many people as just eating more broccoli or having more vegetables. I don't want to minimize a lot of the mental health challenges that people have been facing, especially during the pandemic. But in life generally, a lot of things can happen that can really feel very difficult. And there are certain mental health conditions that will require, you know, things like therapy and other approaches to really help people. But that's not to say that food can't play a really important role. And there is some research behind that as well. It's interesting. I read some research from Taiwan to say that that people who are eating more folate-rich foods subjectively said they felt a lot happier. There's research from Felissa Jacks to show that actually having a more Mediterranean style diet as an intervention, as a randomized controlled trial, is a really interesting way of improving overall mood scores, and in fact was more effective than things like social support in that particular trial. There's studies from the US to show that people that were working for an insurance company when they were part of this controlled trial to eat more fruits, vegetables, legumes, grains, that they were able not only to improve workplace productivity, but also overall mood scores as well. So we can see on a practical level that it can definitely help. And it kind of makes sense because these are the foods that nourish us from the inside out. There are certain components of these foods that can be really helpful for helping us to create neurotransmitters that help us to feel good. I don't know if you've talked about this with your audience before, but tryptophan, the amino acid, is one of the precursors for serotonin, which is one of our feel-good hormones. And we know that actually having fiber-rich foods that are also rich in tryptophan is a lovely way of potentially improving our mood, because those amino acids can go directly through the blood-brain barrier. There's a lot of talk about gut health and how it connects with mental health, and that's true. But the serotonin that's made in the gut doesn't actually cross the blood-brain barrier, whereas the tryptophan, which is the precursor for it, can. So there was one study which showed that if you have foods that are high in tryptophan, that it can be beneficial for mental health. But interestingly, there may also be some competition between amino acids as to which one gets in, to pass the blood-brain barrier. So having fiber-rich sources of tryptophan may potentially be having an additional benefit as well.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. So I would love to learn a little bit more about stress itself. We all have been primed to know, I guess, that stress is bad for us. You hear stress is bad, don't be stressed, stress is bad. But why is it so bad for us? What is it actually doing physiologically? And I guess I would love to learn about the impact of stress on the immune system as well.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting that you say that, and that stress is bad, because stress is not necessarily inherently a bad thing. It's important for us to have a fully functioning fight or flight response for times of need. But what can make it really troublesome for us in our lives is if we find ourselves in a more constant feedback loop of stress, because that is potentially quite damaging for us physiologically. If we have high levels of cortisol and adrenaline over long periods of time, it can actually dampen our immune response. Our immune system is tremendously complex, and in times gone by, we would have had times at which it would have been vital to run from a predator or from danger. But then the rest of the time, we could maintain a generally more peaceful physiology. We could be living in our parasympathetic nervous system, our rest and renew nervous system, which is where our immune system tends to thrive. We're able to make our immune cells more efficiently when we're in that parasympathetic place. And in modern society, in modern life, perhaps with social media, increasing anxiety, we find ourselves more in that fight or flight response, which means that it does dampen our immune response as well. Those cortisol and adrenaline hormones essentially mean that, you know, we're producing less of those helpful immune cells at that time. So it is important to address chronic stress. And chronic stress can also lead to levels of chronic inflammation inside the body, oxidative stress, which again is something that, you know, we have to have a certain amount of. And in fact, oxidative stress happens in our bodies all the time. It's part of being alive. You know, we have to use oxygen for a lot of our body processes. But again, it's where that can go too far that we then sort of start to run into problems and we become depleted.
Awesome. So you've written in your book that stress is actually immunosuppressive. So could you just break down what that statement means? And what can we do about it?
Well, this book doesn't go into mental health and stress, but I do talk a little bit about oxidative stress and how it can affect us. And as I said, you know, we have free radicals produced in our body through a number of physiological mechanisms, and they are active oxygen molecules. And I like to think of it as a bit like pins in a pinball machine. They're bouncing around inside our cells, and they're fast moving, and they can cause damage as they go. And there are certain things that we can do to reduce that oxidative damage. And those things are mediated generally through the donation of electrons. They can sort of soothe those free radicals, those oxygen species, into sort of calming down and bouncing around much less, if you like the analogy. So fruits and vegetables are amazing because they are essentially electron donators, which is why you might have heard of things like blueberries being called antioxidant. They actually donate electrons to these oxidative species. And that's an important process to allow to reduce inflammation generally. Interestingly, the same thing can actually apply, I guess, when you're just walking around barefoot on the grass, because again, it's about the electrons in the ground and the earth and how they can actually, you know, be used to reduce oxidative stress in our bodies. There's less data around that. There's only a very small handful of studies on the potential benefits of grounding. But we know a lot more, of course, about the roles of fruits and vegetables and those kinds of foods to allow to reduce oxidative stress. So that's sort of a basic mechanism by which it might happen.
Great explanation. I did like the pinball analogy. My brain was there.
And combined with the British accent, I was oh, I'm watching Discovery Channel.
It's so soothing. So is it just plant foods that are antioxidant, have that mechanism of electron donating?
Yeah, I mean, basically, yes. I mean, when you're eating animal products, there are certain nutrients that you're getting, there are certain vitamins and minerals, but generally speaking, you may have other issues as well that come alongside that. So, you know, we have other potential carcinogens, for example, in certain meat products. Heme iron is very oxidizing. So iron is a crucial element that we need for our bodies, but when we have it in the form of heme iron, it can be oxidizing, whereas non-heme iron is less so. Having said that, we may not necessarily absorb so much of the non-heme iron, so it'd be important to make sure that you are using, depending on your own personal circumstances, like if you're known to have low iron stores, then a great way of boosting the amount of non-heme iron you get from fruits, vegetables, legumes, and whole grains is by having a source of vitamin C with your iron-rich foods. So maybe squeezing some lemon over your curry, for example, something like that. And also avoiding tannins from things like tea. So having those at different times of day from when you're eating is another way of increasing the amount of iron that you're getting from your food. But generally speaking, the anti-inflammatory, antioxidant component of the diet tends to be much more fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and legumes.
So where are some really rich antioxidant foods?
Well, obviously, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and legumes are generally fantastic for antioxidants. But if you wanted a particularly concentrated source, berries are brilliant. Things like blueberries and raspberries and whatever berries you have where you live. And things like green tea can be great. Matcha is a particularly great source as well. And yeah, I think as long as you're prioritizing fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, whole grains, and legumes, you're going to be having a lovely broad range of antioxidant rich foods.
Thank awesome. You. So I've heard that, and we've spoken about this particular issue with a few other guests, that the fact that plants actually go through stress and they've adapted to this stress by producing these polyphenols and things, which are hugely, as you're saying, are antioxidants. So is basically what you're saying is like we can really, I guess, benefit or absorb what the plant has adapted to from, you know, to its through colds and fighting off viruses and all things that the plant has to do to survive. We actually get those benefits as well.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. You know, that's why I suppose we've evolved side by side with nature. And it's good to be able to take advantage of those mechanisms that the plants have used to protect themselves. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's really healthy for us.
Awesome. So would you then suggest, do you suggest your patients eat organic if possible? For are those sorts of foods higher in these antioxidant properties?
I haven't read any data to suggest that organic foods are higher in antioxidants. If you know of any, let me know and I'll have a look at it. I think when it comes to the benefits of fruits and vegetables, I tend to suggest having more fruits and veggies generally is great. A lot of the population-based data that we have on the benefits and power of plant-based nutrition comes from eating conventionally grown foods. There are a few studies, the most notable of which I believe happened in France, to show that there could be a potential increased risk of a certain kind of cancer, B-cell lymphoma, when populations are having conventionally grown foods as opposed to organic. But there are also long-term large population data studies to show that fruits and vegetables are healthy no matter where they came from. So I think it's really about finding what is practical for the person in front of me. I've got a lot of patients who can't afford to spend money on organic produce and are eating a lot of ultra-processed foods, convenience foods, maybe haven't learnt or not been had access to the ability to learn how to cook. And so, you know, I guess it depends really where you're coming from as to where you're aiming to get to and what can sort of feel practical and available in your life. I personally do buy organic products mostly, not everything. And I think there are certain products that are probably easier to get hold of that are organic versus non-organic. Sometimes it's helpful to know about certain things like the skins, like bananas and avocados. It may not necessarily be as important to have those things organic. I think it can be a contentious issue for people, especially if they don't have the budget for it. And I'd love to chat for a long time about, you know, the constraints in society and where we are right now and where I'd like to see things go and how I'd like to see regenerative or conservation agricultural techniques prioritized in the future so that we can minimize excess use of pesticides, just as we minimize excess use of antibiotics in my practice. And there's loads of things I could talk about with that. But I think probably the take home message is to just eat more vegetables wherever they come from. And then if you're interested to learn more about how to support local farmers with conservation agriculture techniques, because they're not always organic certified, but they can be tremendously helpful for the soil. So again, it can be a little bit of a nuanced issue, but it depends where you're starting from as to where you go.
We often talk to our community about going to the farmer's market, and you can just have the conversation with the farmer if you have that opportunity, obviously, to and say, hey, this may not be, you know, officially organic, but if you have the conversation with them, they're like,
yeah, how do you grow it?
Yeah, and it can still be just as affordable as getting it from the supermarket. So
yeah, exactly. And that's a lovely thing. I would, you know, that's a great thing to recommend, because you're getting to know the person that grew your food. And that food is hard to grow. I don't know if anybody's tried to have, you know, like a vegetable garden, but it's a real struggle. And I think it's great to have that respect for how the food is grown and how difficult it can be, what a skill it can be. You know, I think, you know, our farmers are our agricultural superheroes. And if we can support them in going back to healthy and conservational agricultural techniques, then all the better.
Awesome. We spoke about tryptophan before, and I thought that was really curious what you were saying, just the important role amino acids can play and they can cross the blood-brain barrier. What I didn't know if we covered some specific, you know, your go-to foods that are plants that are high in tryptophan.
So things like pumpkin seeds and butternut squash are particularly high in tryptophan and also fiber. I think that sunflower seeds as well are a great high tryptophan food source. So think about your kind of orange vegetables, root vegetables, and seeds would be a great source of tryptophan as well.
Awesome. Great. I heard you mention fiber there. So I'm guessing as well that those foods would be great for our gut bugs.
Oh, yes. And we all love nurturing our gut bugs. And hopefully most of your audience are now really excited by the idea of how fiber can help them to do that. Fiber is so important for feeding those beneficial gut bacteria. And they can help produce short chain fatty acids, which actually have a role to play in regulating some of the hormones, some of our stress hormones too, which is another mechanism by which our food can help our mood, because they can regulate some of those things like dopamine, for example, in our intestine. And so fiber is really, really important for maintaining good mental health as well as everything else, immune health. It's great for modulating both.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So I'm hoping we could dive a little bit more into oxidative stress. What would be some ways that we are maybe unwittingly raising our levels or leading to, I don't know how to word this, unsustainable levels of oxidative stress? What is the end result of that?
There's lots of different ways, I think, in modern society that we could. Again, I think a lot of the things in our body are very much connected. So if we sort of circle back towards the microbiome, and you know, you're talking about the role of fiber and how important that is for microbial health and for our mood, but also just generally supporting those microbial populations is important for reducing oxidative stress. And there are lots of ways in which our gut microbiome can be impacted by the modern world, not just the food that we eat. They have their own circadian rhythm. So late nights can actually have an impact on our immune health and our gut health for that reason. People who live in urban environments potentially have a slightly depleted gut microbiome compared to those who live in less urban environments. Pesticide exposures that could reduce the health of our gut microbiome, which makes total sense because pesticides are obviously designed to be antimicrobial. And of course, if you're eating those foods, then they may well to have a strong effect on our microbes. So what else? I mean, there are so many. Thinking about the pollution in the ocean, you've got PCBs and microplastics that can disrupt our hormones and potentially also disrupt our gut microbiome and cause oxidative stress. I don't want it to feel too overwhelming, though. I think sometimes you might listen to something like this and think, well, what can I do? Everything is toxic. You know, that's not how I don't want people to feel that way. I want people to feel empowered and hopeful and excited. And I think, you know, knowing about some of the things that you can do in and around your home and on your plate to help you feel better is I'm hoping, a really empowering thing to do. So prioritizing fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes, thinking about your water and air quality, if that's something that is on your radar, if that's something that you've got the mental bandwidth to do, looking perhaps into like water filter, for example, might be good depending on where you live. If you're in a very urban environment with lots of air pollution, thinking about making your home a place where you've perhaps got an air filter, for example, so that at least when you're asleep and when you're in your home, you have a place where you've got less air pollution exposure. So those things, those kinds of things that I think might make a really important impact. Using green spaces, hopefully wherever you're living, you may have access to a local park, which is a lovely way of calming the nervous system, thereby also soothing your immune system, taking in those phytoncides from plant compounds, the varied microbiome that you can breathe in through being in those green spaces, looking at the fractals and those recurring patterns in nature as you look up into the trees. These are all things that are free and freely available, hopefully, for most people. And it's things like that that I think can have a really tremendous impact without people even realizing it.
Beautiful.
Interesting. Yeah, I love that. And particularly as you'll be thinking during a pandemic, like these things are free, available to everyone. And obviously the curious thing is that the people that we know that are suffering from more severe COVID-related symptoms are typically those that are metabolically compromised. So, our immune system, starting with our gut and, eating the right foods, is a huge step forward into protecting us from, obviously, not just COVID, but from everything else that is trying to assault us in this toxic world.
Yeah, and there was an interesting study that came out recently on medical professionals in the UK. They did dietary questionnaires, and they found in the medical professionals who had been exposed to COVID, those who had had a more plant-based diet tended to have less severe disease, which I thought was a really interesting emerging study. I found that study really interesting. And obviously, we can't extrapolate that onto a large population of people. We can't prematurely come to any conclusions, but it was so encouraging to see that data. And it does fit with what we already know about the benefits for our overall well-being and health to having a plant-predominant diet.
Well said. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Gemma, for joining us today. We've loved learning more about you and about plants and getting us more excited about seeing all that rainbow on our plates. So thank you so much. You have a book, The Plant Powered Doctor, that came out in January, and it's become a bestseller, which is really exciting. So if anyone listening wants to learn more about you and get their hands on that book, where would they find it?
Well, they would find it at gemmanewman.com. or at any good bookstore. my website actually has loads of free resources and links and articles and things that might be of interest to your audience. So if they want to just head along to gemmanewman.com or plantpowerdoctor.com, it takes you to the same place. You should be able to find links to my book and loads of resources there. And of course, on Instagram.
Excellent. Which is the Plant Power Doctor?
Yes, that's plant right. Power. Well done, Sarah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again. It's been a pleasure having you. We'll have to get you back again soon to talk about even more things. It was actually tricky to figure out what to talk about with you today, just because I actually had my team coming up with ideas about what we could interview. And it was like, oh, we could ask her on this or this or this. I think she'd be good on this and this as well. So we'll have to get one of those other topics, because it's been such a lovely chat. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Well, that was awesome. Really enjoyed that. So let us know in the comments what you thought of the interview below. I thought there were some really great snippets there on antioxidants and what they do, and as well on amino acids and tryptophan. And maybe some of the, maybe you've heard about this thing about serotonin being made in your gut and thinking that that serotonin is what gets up in your brain, which is a little bit more nuanced than that. So I loved how she clarified that as well, which has been awesome. So let us know in the comments what you thought. And if you really like us, give us a like and a subscribe. That would really make our day. So hit those buttons and we will see you guys next week.
See you then.